government that, like, we don't want anything to do with you. We've never gotten anything good out of you. So we're going to do our own thing. And it's very, very inspiring. I've been there a few times, and it's just incredible what they've been able to do. In terms of the political consciousness that they have, it's so advanced and so open, more than anything I've been close to. And also because they've created their own literature and their own art. They've really invested in this imaginary. It's very inspiring, and it's very, it has a very strong poetic element, I think, the Zapatista movement. I am a big admirer, and I go there, as, you know, whenever I can. You should check them out.
Do the students have any closing questions?
Anything up and coming? Like any project?
I got a grant to continue doing my work with the Mayan community in Portland. And one thing that I'm really excited about is that there's this rapper, Pad Boy is his name, and he raps in Mayan, and it's incredible. And I really want to bring him to Portland. So part of the grant is going to go toward bringing him to Portland next summer and to do some work with you. Well, I'm really, really excited about that part because I just think it's incredible what he does. You should check him out, Pat Boy, P-A-T, and then Boy.
So be sure to follow us on Instagram at Reynolds Art Show. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Patricia, for being here today. And be sure to listen on SoundCloud and KVU.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Awesome.
If you want to go check out more of Patricia's work, you can go to cargocollective.com/patriciavinku.
Thanks so much for coming. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis. And this is Cool Solutions, climate action from the bottom up.
Back in 2019, a team of engineers from RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, announced that they'd found a way to turn carbon dioxide back into coal, using just a small amount of energy, enough to heat the ingredients to body temperature. After the initial flurry of press, there was radio silence on the topic. Maybe it wasn't reproducible, maybe it wasn't scalable, or maybe the Australian coal industry put the kibosh on it. We don't know.
But we do know that we don't have to wait for engineers to figure out how to pull carbon dioxide from the air. This is the second episode in our mini-series on natural climate solutions, and our topic is a new program which could get U.S. forests to pull 2 gigatons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
Guy Dunkel has a lifelong passion for forests.
When I was 5 years old, I remember walking different forests with my parents, talking with them about the pluses and minuses, the advantages and disadvantages of different forest lands.
His parents bought one of those forests in Pennsylvania. They farmed Christmas trees out front, and the woods beyond were Guy's playground.
Just a lot of time spent in creeks, flipping over rocks, catching crayfish, things like that. And I remember being 6 or 7 years old with my best friend and coming across a black bear in the woods, and just a lot of memories that really engaged me in the forest. And so I've had that with me my whole life.
Guy grew up to become a professional forester and a forest owner in his own right. He and his wife have an 183-acre farm with 83 acres of forest. It may surprise you, it certainly surprised me, to learn that family forest owners like Guy own the majority of forest land in the U.S. Not the federal government, big timber companies, or some other corporate monolith, but a large number of individuals with small holdings. Guy's forest is just slightly larger than average. Together, all our forests currently absorb about 13% of our nation's greenhouse gas emissions, but in terms of carbon removal, they're underachieving by 40%. If we want to improve on that, small forest owners like Guy are important players.
When Guy talks about his trees, you can hear the love of the land in his voice.
One really amazing and wonderful thing about the forests of the eastern United States is the huge diversity of tree species that we have here. We probably have something like 15 different tree species present just in our little forest and farm here. Aspen, hemlock, winterberry holly and dogwood, red maple, sugar maple, black cherry, northern red oak, white oak, yellow birch, eastern hemlock, white pine, white ash, green ash, and black ash, one hickory.
Guy says you can read the forest like a history book.
In this area of Pennsylvania, our forests have been drastically shaped and molded by interactions with people over several centuries. So what that means is that the species composition of our forest is not necessarily a result of natural conditions exclusively. It's also a result of, let's say, the farmers, the previous owners preferred sugar maple because they like to make maple syrup. Well, they may have cut the other species and left behind sugar maple. Or let's say they decided that they wanted to cut a bunch of firewood in a specific year, and that year overlapped with a heavy seed crop of red oak. Well, we have a patch of about 6 acres on our farm that's very heavily concentrated to red oak, very close in age. So we know there must have been a human disturbance at some point in time that let sunlight in, and red oak was what coincided with that disturbance. So that's one of the things that we love to do walking around our forest with our children, is to think about what we see today and what previous people who have been in this forest might have done to give us the forest that we see today.
This history of human intervention in Guy's area began when it was settled by farmers back in the 1800s.
The forest was kind of a family subsistence provider. So the forest would provide firewood, maple syrup, but it wasn't necessarily thought of as a commodity, as a producer of sellable lumber. So it was just provided the family with what they might need from the forest.
Forests in Pennsylvania still feed families and keep them warm, but now they do it as a cash crop.
What I've seen in my interactions and conversations with my neighbors is that short-term income is the driver of most people's decision-making. And what's interesting is if you look at the research being done from Penn State University, when they interview forest landowners, such as myself and my neighbors, and ask, what's your priority? What drives your decision-making? Our response to the survey is things like wildlife, habitat, aesthetics, recreation. Those are the most important things to us. However, in practice, what we do is when a logger or a forester shows up at our doorstep with a large check in hand and says, I'd like to cut your timber, here's a chunk of money. In practice, we end up making that decision time and time again, deciding to harvest timber more heavily than is appropriate because it generates a lot of income. And I live in a pretty poor area. And so that's a really appealing prospect when somebody knocks at your door with a check for $50,000.
They come knocking on your door?
Many of my neighbors and my friends, fellow landowners in the area, we get mailings all the time, postcards and letters. You've got money standing in your forest. Money does grow on trees. Let us tell you how. And all these solicitations being encouraged to harvest timber. And of course, the people that are making those solicitations, they really don't have much motivation to do anything other than harvest as much value as possible, because those folks are paid by volume, they're paid on commission, and whatever their compensation is, it tends to compensate them more for cutting more trees. It's not that those loggers and foresters are bad people, they're just working within a system that incentivizes them to do poor work. It provides no incentive for the forester to do things like manage for carbon sequestration or address invasive species, build resilience in the forest to withstand future impacts.
There's not much nearby in the way of economic alternatives. Many of Guy's neighbors are what I'd call land poor.
When I grew up 30 years ago, I can remember all the small 50-cow dairies or 100-cow dairies in this area, and that was the driver of the local economy. And that's gone. What's taken over is larger industrial-scale milk farms that are not even located here. And so what happened is that that vacuum has come into place where dairy drove our economy. That's gone. People still own the land, but they don't have another way to derive the income from that. And that's where timber offers an opportunity. We don't have a lot of money, but we do have a lot of this resource.
Today, Pennsylvania is the nation's largest provider of hardwood lumber, but traditional methods of logging here are not sustainable.
We all know about the impact of climate change on western forests, the wildfires and massive die-offs from bark beetles, but it's affecting eastern forests as well. Todd Ontel is a forest adaptation specialist at the Northern Institute of Applied Climate Sciences. He's working to help northeastern forests survive in a changing climate.
Precipitation is increasing, but temperatures are increasing even faster. So there's going to be drier air conditions, faster evaporation, so more moisture stress in our forests. Our winters are warming, and so some pests are moving further north because the growing season is longer. Some insect pests, now they're having two generations of progeny as opposed to having just one generation. And so you can imagine this exponential increase in terms of damage to a forest.
Some tree species might not even grow here in the future.
Our institute has developed a resource called the Climate Change Tree Atlas. You can go to the website and you can see how tree habitat suitability is projected to change into the future for individual tree species. Not only does it tell you what tree species are going to be the climate change losers, but it can also tell you what tree species aren't there currently that maybe we could get established. It's called assisted migration. That's sort of a controversial issue. There's a lot of debate about doing that. But then there's sort of a middle piece in between, which is there are oftentimes tree species that may be kind of rare in your forest. Or maybe it's not in your forest, but it's one or two counties to the south. Maybe you're right on the edge of its range. And it's not wild and crazy to be managing for them, because they're going to be adapted to future conditions. That work's happening really all over the eastern U.S.
The problems have already started. In eastern forests, trees are not replanted after logging. They regenerate naturally from seeds and seedlings that are already there. In Pennsylvania, over the last few decades, this natural regeneration process has started to fail. State forest surveys found that over half the log sites which have adequate sunlight fail to regenerate native trees, largely due to competition from invasive species. In the battle between natives and invasives, climate change puts the home team at a disadvantage.
Invasive species have a more exuberant response to rising levels of carbon dioxide.
They lack natural enemies and may have more tolerance for warmer temperatures and drier soil. Punching big holes in the canopy invites in that competition, and Guy says even if trees manage to overcome it, they may not be the same trees that were there before.
The forest that comes back may not resemble the forest that was harvested. We may get different species that grow there. We may get monocultures of fewer tree species that are more susceptible to diseases. That's the status quo process that generates a lot of income for landowners. But it's very questionable how sustainable that process is. I don't know what plant species or tree species will be able to grow here in 50 years due to the question mark that is climate change.
Forests are not only victims of climate change, they could be saviors. Worldwide, forests are absorbing 30% of human-caused greenhouse gas emissions each year. In the U.S., that percentage is more like 10 to 15%, but it could be much more.
So how do you increase carbon in forests? What do we want forest owners to do?
Todd is part of a team developing strategies to protect and increase forest carbon stores.
There are those things that rise to the top as being most important for forests and carbon. And those things are retaining the big trees, allowing trees to get bigger, enhancing the carbon pools in dead wood, and then taking care of the forest soils, because forest soils store nearly half of the carbon in a forest.
Don't dead trees just rot and release their carbon back into the atmosphere?
A tree takes decades to decompose, so that's storing carbon for decades that if you burned it would go into the atmosphere immediately. And then it's adding nutrients and carbon to the soil, which is maintaining the fertility and the productivity of the site. And that's going to help the next generation of trees to grow. It's a positive feedback, a healthier faster growing forest in the future.
So that old expression about getting rid of the dead wood doesn't hold up to scientific scrutiny.
Speaking of scientific scrutiny, there's been a whole lot of folks trying to answer the question, how would we manage our forests if we put carbon first? We looked at a number of studies comparing what happens with forest carbon under different management scenarios, and the conclusions were always the same.
We get the greatest amount of carbon benefit by simply leaving our existing forests to grow.
This is what's called proforestation, a new term that means protecting and allowing existing forests to realize their full carbon storage potential, which keeps increasing for at least 200 years. Planting baby trees is important, but proforestation is an effective, low-cost, and most importantly, more immediate way to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But we've already heard that family forest owners rely on timber harvests, and we all need wood, so the next best thing to no harvesting is to leave the big trees alone.
Those big trees really matter. In a mature forest, a large majority of the carbon exists in a few large trees. You can designate legacy trees that you just let grow and you don't harvest them. You can extend your harvest entry cycle, let trees grow an additional 20, 30 years. Those are ways that we can increase the amount of carbon in a forest.
You're listening to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. I'm Wendy Ring, and my co-host Brian Curtis and I are deep in the forests of Northeast Pennsylvania, learning about a project to help trees here remove more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We've been talking with forester Guy Dunkel and forest adaptation specialist Todd Ontel, and we're about to meet Josh Parrish and Christine Cadigan of the Family Forest Carbon Project. Todd just told us what forest owners in an ideal world would do to increase forest carbon removal. But unfortunately, that's not what's happening. Josh Parrish is another Pennsylvania forest owner and director of the Nature Conservancy's Working Woodlands Program.
He explains a common practice called high grading.
About every 15 years here in the eastern United States in the mid-Atlantic, the landowner has a need for money. And the quickest way to get the highest dollars possible per acre is to cut all of your largest and best trees. 30% of your trees could be 85% of the value of the forest. So 30% of the trees are harvested. And your best trees in stock are gone.
Let's talk about that 30%. The value of the forest is concentrated in these trees, and so is the above-ground stored carbon. At best, 25% of a harvested tree and its carbon actually ends up in a durable wood product. The rest is emitted back into the atmosphere, either by burning or decomposing. After a heavy cut, it takes 20 years for a forest to return from being a carbon source to a carbon sink, and more than 100 years to regain all the stored carbon that was lost. Now let's talk about the trees left behind. They're basically the runts of the litter. Most forests in the U.S. have been clear-cut at one time or another, so most of the trees in a stand are the same age. The smaller trees are poorer quality. They have less resistance to pests and climate impacts and don't grow as fast or sequester as much carbon as the big trees that were removed. That's why, from a carbon perspective, we want to leave the best and biggest trees standing.
So not high grading and foregoing the fast buck is one way to keep more carbon in the forest.
Another is to control invasive species. So when there's an opening in the canopy from tree death or harvest, the forest successfully regenerates. That can be very labor and money intensive, which raises the issue of who's going to pay.
In addition to managing his own forests, Guy works for a nonprofit, a land trust which has purchased 2,000 acres of forest.
We're just not going to get this done fast enough if we have to raise money to buy up all the forest. But what if you could do the same thing on 200 million acres without having to own any of it?
Thank you.
Meet Christine Cadigan, family forest owner in Virginia.
We just celebrated our 3-year anniversary as forest landowners. It was a proud moment for us to really realize that dream.
As a proud forest owner and a mother, Christine wants her forest to contribute to the fight against climate change. But she also needs to generate some income to pay for the land she just bought.
Large forest owners do that by selling carbon credits to companies that want to offset their greenhouse gas emissions. For example, let's say that Delta Airlines wants to say it's carbon neutral, but its jets are burning fossil fuel. So they pay a forest owner to go beyond standard practice so their trees absorb as much carbon as Delta's airplanes emit.
Carbon credits have the potential to support climate solutions at a scale that governments aren't yet willing to fund. But there are problems. We'll talk about two big ones. First, the justice issue. Industries that emit carbon also emit pollution, most often in Black, brown, and low-income communities. To people in those communities, carbon credits are just greenwashing. For example, an oil refinery in Louisiana's Cancer Alley can buy carbon credits in rural Pennsylvania, keep polluting its own neighborhood, and call itself carbon neutral. And since we're holding a ticking climate time bomb, do we really want to trade carbon removal here for carbon emissions there and get half the benefit? Or do we want to do both? Stop emitting more carbon and start removing some of the carbon we've already put into the atmosphere. I vote for door number two.
Then there's the high cost that keeps small forest owners like Guy, Josh, and Christine out.
Traditional forest carbon projects measure the carbon stocks in the forest. They literally have to get an inventory and basically measure every stick of wood in the forest.
That has to be done over and over, and it's expensive. To break even, a forest has to be at least 1,500 acres.
The average family forest is more like 70 acres.
I, as a landowner, could not just shell out $10,000 to sign up for a program. And I probably wouldn't get enough revenue back to even cover the cost of that, so it just doesn't make sense for me to sign up.
But fortunately, Christine and Josh are a lot more than forest owners. In their day jobs, she works for the American Forest Foundation, and he heads up the Working Woodland Program at the Nature Conservancy. And together, they've created the Family Forest Carbon Program to unlock the huge carbon removal potential of small privately owned forests like theirs.
We had an amazing team that has done an excellent job of thinking outside the box and developing a methodology that refuses to depend on those things which were blocking landowners from entering these programs.
The Family Forest Carbon Program works differently from the current system, where larger forest owners certify and sell their own carbon credits. Instead of getting paid for carbon, owners will get paid for their actions.
If I'm a participant in the Family Forest Carbon Program, I am paid to implement a practice, so a forest management activity of some kind, that when you compare it with what other landowners in the region are doing, will store more carbon. It'll have a greater carbon benefit.
The landowners don't have to do any carbon accounting. The project does that, using a new methodology which costs 75% less because it aggregates all the forests in a region and analyzes samples instead of each one. Now people with family forests as small as 30 acres can get economic support to help fight climate change. They pick the practice they want to adopt, sign a long-term contract, and the project pays them a portion up front and the rest in annual installments. Then the project sells the carbon credits and uses the proceeds to fund more forest owners adopting more practices. And they won't be selling their credits to wanton polluters.
We want to work with those companies that have reduced their own emissions as much as they can. They have these residual emissions that technology just doesn't yet exist for them to be able to reduce those emissions even further. And after they've gone through all of the things that they can possibly do, our program will provide natural climate solution options.
The process is starting off with a pilot in the central Appalachian region of Pennsylvania, where forests have been so degraded that a change in practices is expected to bring big carbon benefits.
Choosing eastern forests makes a lot of sense because they have high rates of carbon sequestration and there's more chance of keeping that carbon in the forest. Western forests have a higher risk of going from carbon sinks to carbon sources, with increasing wildfires and pine bark beetles that have killed tens of millions of acres.
The Pennsylvania pilot is starting off with just two practices. The first is called Growing Future Forests. It's a 10-year contract to help with that forest regeneration problem.
There are a lot of native and non-native species that will crowd out the baby trees that we want to see grow. And so the competing vegetation practice enables landowners to afford to control that competing vegetation and basically free up space, sunlight, water for the trees that we actually want to grow. The second practice is a 20-year practice, and that's what we call growing mature forests.
That means paying landowners to limit their harvests and preserve the larger trees for 20 years. Josh and Christine say surveys and interviews indicate that many folks would be willing to forego high grading in exchange for modest incentives.
Paying landowners to increase forest carbon will help them do what they already want. We know what that is because every 5 years, the U.S. Forest Service sends every forest owner a survey asking them about their goals and priorities.
Guy agrees.
Management for carbon sequestration dovetails well with the objectives that people state, things like owning their land and managing it for good aesthetics, for good wildlife habitat, and all of your recreational experiences. Those objectives that people have, the management style that would maximize those is really the same or very close to the management style that would maximize carbon sequestration rates. The problem is that's never paid the bills. That didn't cover property taxes. That didn't cover the other expenses that life throws at people. And so typically, we as forest landowners have compromised our objectives in order to pay the bills and make ends meet. And if carbon credits offer, even if it's less income, if they offer some form of income for us to do what we really want to do, I think that's the beauty of this.
Josh says from a long-term financial perspective, forest owners will at least do more than break even.
Over a 20-year period, it actually pencils for the landowner to be a positive outcome financially. That's driven by really two things. It's driven by that upfront payment and then the maintenance payments over the 20-year period, plus the fact that at the end of the 20-year period, the landowner has a healthier, more productive, and higher quality forest.
Traditional forest carbon credits require a 100-year contract to make sure that the carbon stays in the forest, but family forest contracts are only for 20. After that, the owner can cut the big trees and the carbon is gone, right?
True, but it does buy us 20 years during a critical period of time, and it won't buy us anything if no one wants to sign up.
We try to keep contracts as short as possible because our number one feedback from landowners is the traditional carbon contracts are too long. We hypothesize that actually most landowners will choose to re-enroll their property because they will appreciate the product that they have at the end of 20 years. And even if they don't re-enroll, they've understood the benefit and the reward associated with letting their trees grow longer and bigger and the yields associated with that. We don't actually think that everyone is just going to liquidate their forest after the last day of their contract.
Here's the nuts and bolts. Forest owners start the process by checking the eligibility of their property at the program website. Then they have a conversation with program staff.
We want to understand, you know, why they own the land, what's important to them, the current condition of the forest.
Then the program pays for a qualified forester to make a site visit.
The forester's role is translating all of that into a plan that a landowner is comfortable with the activities and the long-term outcomes that everybody's shooting for.
Once the plan is completed, the forest owner signs the contract and starts getting paid.
The project is signing up its first batch of family forests in Pennsylvania as we speak. So if you own a family forest in Pennsylvania, go check them out at familyforestcarbon.org.
Massachusetts and Vermont will be next. The Carbon Project hopes to spread all across the country, expanding its menu of carbon-removing practices as it goes. Their goal? Recruit one of every five family forest owners in the U.S. to adopt a forest carbon practice in the next 10 years and remove 2 gigatons of carbon by the end of the century.
I'm Brian Curtis.
I'm Wendy Ring, and you've been listening to Cool Solutions, Climate Action from the Bottom Up. Many thanks to our guests.
Guy Dunkel, Todd Ontel,
Josh Parrish, and Christine Cadigan. And to Scott Holmes, Sergei Cheremisinov, Livio Amato, and Jason Shaw for our music.
K KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG. This slideshow depicts part two of Barbara Bernstein's radio documentary series, Holding the Thin Green Line, which explores what is at stake in Southern Oregon if the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connected Gas Pipeline get built. From July 27th to the 31st, this slideshow video can be viewed at your own convenience at holdingthethingreenline.org/Jordan Cove slideshow. Then on July 31st from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., we'll hold a live Q&A session with impacted landowners, community organizers, and land and water protectors who are featured in the documentary. Again, that's The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG documentary slideshow screening, July 27th to the 31st, and a live on Zoom Q&A on July 31st. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Esta es una sección especial en español en respuesta a la emergencia del